Okay, so good morning, everyone. On behalf of SAIS CNS, it's a pleasure to welcome you to SAIS Distinguished Lecture Series. I am Gurdeep Singh. I'm the Division Director for the Computer and Network Systems Division. This is one of the units within the Computer Science and Engineering Directorate. So before I start with the introductions and the distinguished lecture, just want to go over some logistics information. So we will have the lecture presentation now, and I want to remind everyone that today at 3 p.m. Eastern, we will also have office hours that our distinguished lecturer will join, and we'll have the opportunity to engage in more one-on-one conversations with him at that point. So please do join that. And also want to mention that during the lecture, just use the Q&A feature to type in your questions. We will assemble all those questions, and when the Q&A session begins, we will start with answering those questions. So with that, it's a great pleasure to have Dr. Stenkovic today as our distinguished lecturer. And Dr. Stenkovic, he's the BP America Professor of Computer Science in the Computer Science Department at the University of Virginia, and he's also the director of the Link Lab there. He received his PhD from Brown University. And he's an accomplished researcher and has a long list of achievements and honors, and I will just mention a few. He's the fellow of both IEEE and ACM. He was awarded an honorary directorate from the University of York, UK, for his work on real-time systems. He has won the IEEE Real-Time Systems Technical Committee's Award for Outstanding Technical Contribution Leaderships. He's also won the Test of Time Paper Award, 8 Best Paper Award, and in 2015, he was awarded University of Virginia's Distinguished Research Scientist Award. Again, as I said, the long list is long, and I would refer to you to his bio to look at those. His research interest has been in the area of real-time systems, wireless sensor networks, smart and connected health, smart cities, cyber-physical system, and IoT. He's been working on, you know, looking at all of these technologies applied to the healthcare domain. So today he's going to talk about towards ambient intelligence and smart healthcare. With this, I would like to welcome Jack for his presentation.
Thank you, Gurdeep. So it's a pleasure to be here. I thank you for the invitation. And just mention one thing about the Link Lab. It was started in 2018. Its focus is on cyber-physical systems research. And it's grown to 40 faculty and over 200 grad students. So it's a pretty large enterprise. So I was asked to put one slide in about something about myself before we get into the talk. So I thought about that, and I thought I would say, you know, how did I get here? I've been a faculty member for over 40 years. I do a lot of research. I do a lot of teaching. So how did I actually get here? And so I want to briefly say something about the teaching side and the research side. So in teaching, when I was in high school, I was good in math, and my friend was terrible in math, and his mother begged me to tutor him, all right? And so I did that, and it was very satisfying. I could see how rapidly he improved, and he was so happy about it. His mother was even more happy, and so I felt this was great. And also, my sister had a friend. She was in the fourth grade, and she had trouble with math. So they asked me to tutor her, and I did. So I got this love of seeing students really understand information and, you know, learn something. And so I really felt like I should teach. In addition, I always felt like taking so many math and engineering courses, which was most of my engineering courses were all math. I went to a small engineering school, and it didn't have a lot of hands-on, and they never told me why, practically. So I said, I have to be able to teach better than that. You know, you teach me all this math, but I never know why I'm learning it. I know all the mechanisms. And so I really want to teach differently. And when somebody is in my class, I want to make sure they understand why we're learning something. And so that got me into really pushing the notion of I wanted to be a, you know, a teacher. And then in research, when I left undergrad, I had a double E degree. It was a long time ago, and there weren't many programmers. And I ended up going to Bell Labs, and I worked on the anti-ballistic missile system. And I programmed for it in assembler language. And when I got there the first day, they said, "You want to learn how to program?" And I said, "Sure." And they taught me how to program. And then I worked on this project for 4 years. It was such an exciting project with so much research involved with it. And so I thought, you know, I really want to do this, but I didn't feel like I had much of a computer science background. So I said, I need to go back to grad school and learn how to do research in computer science and also have a basis for teaching. And so then now 40 years later, you know, here I am, I'm still doing it. Okay. I thought before I get into the core, I'd do a brief overview of what our group is doing. And so we do a lot of work with wearables and in situ devices. We focus on trying to build devices as into cognitive assistance using a lot of machine learning and natural language processing. That is going to be the theme for today. But I also, there's so many different apps for medical help, for websites with medical information, people telling you what to do for your health. And so there's lots of potential conflicting information. So we spend a lot of time working on identifying conflicting information and resolving it. Acoustics is a powerful modality. We'll talk about that today as well. And we do a lot of work with real deployments. Just briefly, here are some of the projects that emphasize the deployments. We did a project which just completed with understanding family eating dynamics for obese families in Los Angeles. We worked with behavioral psychologists there. We built a system and then deployed it in 23 real families. We have this smartwatch reminder systems, which we're extending into this notion of cognitive assistance. Here we work with our UVA Center for Telemedicine. We currently have a project on the Alzheimer's patient caregiver interaction, where we focus on the caregiver. We want to understand the stress of the caregiver and improve that for them with interventions, basically. And we have three deployments. This is a newer project, and we have three deployments undergoing right at this minute. We have technology for hand washing, which we actually used for a while in the pediatrics intensive care unit at UVA, and I'll talk about that today as well briefly. And we work with first responders, where we work with North Garden Fire and Rescue as a local rescue outfit here, also Richmond Fire. And I did a sabbatical at Oxford, and we have an ongoing project with them where there's other first responders in the UK. And this also fits the theme as cognitive assistant for that work as well. Okay. So one more thing is that in addition to those, we have some newer themes that I also work in smart cities. And we tried to, in that case, we applied formal methods to improve machine learning models. So we want to integrate properties of the system into the models so the models don't give you ludicrous results at times. And so we use formal methods to do that. And also in complex CPS systems, uncertainties are rampant. And so how do we address the uncertainties in the models and in the predictions? And now we're trying to think about how do we move these results into this smart health domain. Okay. So for today, I mean, there's this notion of Internet of Healthcare Things, IOHT. And I want to start with a question, you know, is this hype that this is going to be a revolution, or is it really going to be a revolution? And so what we see today is, you know, we have a lot of smartwatches, more and more sold, like this Apple Watch here, and a lot of the sensors are on there, including an EKG, for example. We have disruptive technologies like smart skin. You could, you know, kind of build sensor circuits and so on and put them on people and monitor various physiological parameters. They're smart homes with a lot of in situ sensors that could be integrated, other disruptive technologies like smart textiles. And I think putting all these together will indeed create a revolution. And let me just give a kind of an overall vision of a revolution. So here's, let's say, this elderly person is living alone. They have a walker. They have maybe in-body sensors. They might have taking now pills for assessment. They may have pacemaker. They have on-body like wearables like a smart watch or pendants. They might have a smartphone, which is almost acting like a medical device in many cases. And then there may even be sensors or actuators on products that help them to be better suited for medical situations. In addition, this person is living in a smart home, and the smart home may have like sensors in the bed to detect sleep quality, medication sensors, and so on, to try to make the environment something to improve healthcare. However, when this person goes out into the city and the smart cities will have various technology also, and they may be monitoring things like air quality. And if this person has asthma, then the air quality could affect that person, and warning the person about that would be helpful. We said there's also the cloud and all this WebMD and other data mining, data collections, and so on, collecting information, personal information. So it's personalized, say, interventions, but also general population information is there. One concept of this ambient intelligence for healthcare would be all of this is a holistic viewpoint, and we see more and more actuations on the for the patient. And in some cases, the actuations are alarms or advice. And then pulling all this together, I believe, is like if all this can work, and all this can work in a synergistic way, you would have this notion of ambient healthcare intelligence. And so today I will talk a bit first about using smartwatches and wearables as basis for cognitive assistance. And that drives us towards this ambient health intelligence. And also, since acoustics is such a powerful modality, especially for healthcare, I'm going to briefly talk about some of our results at getting mood from a microphone. And it is when the microphone is in the environment and not necessarily next to the speaker. And also dealing with anxiety and kind of the new ways we can address that mental health issue. All right, so the cognitive assistance on a smartwatch, is that possible? And generally AI wants to have general intelligence, but general intelligence, I think we're way, way far off. And I think we can make some headway if we talk about more general intelligence for a particular domain like health. So we want this cognitive assistant that's, say, on a smartwatch to interact with healthcare internet services to support conversations so that people can just, kind of talk to it and it talks back, especially for elderly. They really can't see or use a smartwatch very easily on such a small, kind of interface. Second, typical things like reminders, suggestions, alarms, that's been around a long time. But we want to make those explainable, and we want to make them more generic in terms of enabling people to ask questions. We should support both physical and mental health. If the pandemic shows up, we should easily extend the technology to add in information about the pandemic. And of course, privacy is key, but we're not going to discuss privacy. Just to say what we're doing here. So the first thing is we built a system called iAdhere, and it is a verbal medication exercise reminder system. So working with telemedicine, when there are stroke patients and then they go home, they take a smartwatch with them. And then we want to use that smartwatch for medication reminders and exercise reminders. But we want to extend it towards cognitive assistance. So this screen here shows what the watch shows for a reminder of your medication. So the medication, there's a script that when they leave, the script is describing their medication regimen and their exercise regimen. and it automatically gets downloaded to the smartwatch when they're home, and they get a reminder. For example, in the morning, they might get a reminder. It shows up showing the pill. It says, please take this pill at 9 o'clock. And the person could say, which pill is this again? Why am I taking it? What should I have food with it? Should I not have food with it? And all sorts of additional information about that. Many of these patients take 6, 7, 8, even 10 different medications. Then when they need to do exercise, you know, it can tell them which exercise, and they might say, how many repetitions am I supposed to do again? Or do I have to do this every day? So they have a general conversation about exercise, and that could be here. This has already been all implemented. What we're doing with the exercise is we're actually improving it to where we can measure the quality of the exercise as well, and also relate that quality to pain. And so that's where we're trying to, you know, extend the services that exist for dealing with exercise. So it's not just simply a reminder. The person can also say, remind me later. Since the watch has various physiological parameters, they can also say, you know, kind of, here's your EKG, or I want to look at my EKG now, and it would demonstrate that. If I said I wouldn't talk about privacy, but we also allow this screen, like if a person wants privacy and doesn't want the conversation because other people in the room or something like that, then it can be just textual. And so this is kind of what I just said. It's a summary of the basic thing we see in a lot of smartwatches, whatever. There it could be medication, exercise, reminders, but we're trying to drive it to general verbal questions about that, and then allow rescheduling, allow quality, and incorporate physiologic parameters. In this case, an EKG. If you use the Empatica watch, you could even get additional physiological parameters. All right, so I think of this as kind of one notion of kind of taking individual apps and combining them and putting them together to have more comprehensiveness. So I want to, this is the only video I have, and I show a brief demo. The first part shows the watch, and it's only a couple minutes, and the second part shows what's on the web that doctors would see. For the second part, it's not easy to see on the screen, so if you just listen to what's being said, you get an idea of what is what we're storing on the cloud, basically.
Welcome to the demo of MedRem. So I'll receive a reminder. It's for checking ECG. So I tap on the reminder.
It's the time to do an ECG. Do you want to try it now?
Yeah, sure. Please tell me details.
Okay, press the crown to go to apps, tap on the ECG app, and follow the instructions.
Okay, so now I follow the instructions, I go to the ECG apps, and now I can do the ECG. Received a reminder for a pill.
It's time to take your nightly medications. Take all medications as directed by your physician.
Please tell me details.
Metformin and carvedilol.
Okay, thank you. Can you remind me after 1 minute?
Okay, remind you after 1 minute.
Okay, thank you.
You are welcome.
So this is the website for the doctors and the clinicians to view the patient data. It fetches the data from the cloud server with the data from the patient gets uploaded. So let's find the data for the patient 2000. So here we can see that the patient ID and the number of reminders provided, the number of reminders the patient responded, the response rate, and the interaction between the patient and the system for each of the treatment. So by this, the doctors will be able to see what exercise or what medication or what treatment did the patient exactly follow day by day.
Okay, so that was the earlier version of our system, and it's been enhanced. If, for example, that version, you had to tap the watch a couple times to move ahead, which all of that's now automated. Anyway, so when the pandemic came, we also wanted to expand the services. And one way is, you know, kind of integrating additional features into the smartwatch. And what we did is we did a solution for hand washing, which is useful and for general hygiene, even when it's not in the pandemic, like the work we did with the pediatrics intensive care unit in the hospital. Also can say, try to detect mood and anxiety, which I'll talk about these three things that are in red in the rest of the talk. We want to also continue the theme of having voice-based conversations. So the person can ask for pandemic information, you know, how many deaths today, where are the shots available, and so on. They could also get reminders and alert about the about hand washing. They could get different physiological parameters and perhaps use those to detect the whether a person is showing symptoms like coughing and breathing problems. Those can also be added into this. Oops. Okay, so let me focus on a few things and give a little bit more technical details. And the three things I want to focus on, one is the hand washing. And the WHO has guidelines for how you really should wash, and you should be washing hands for at least 20 seconds. And so the idea is we want to develop the quality of doing things, not just the to do or not. And our solution is a hybrid CNN-RNN solution, which I'll show the architecture in a minute. And it also supports conversations about, yes, you did your hand washing well, or you skipped this step, or you skipped that step, or you didn't do it long enough, and so on. These are the 10 steps that I'm not going to dwell on this, but there's 10 different steps that you're supposed to follow. And we try to detect each and every one of those steps. There's a smartwatch app shown here in the middle, and it runs on an Apple Watch, and it will do this detection. Here's a motion sensor that can detect, it's actually a Bluetooth beacon, detect you coming in. And when you come in, it'll give you a reminder that you just returned home and you need to wash your hands. And you can have this conversation back and forth with the watch. So for example, one dialogue, when you enter the home, it might say, time to wash. Okay, I'll do it. You did a good job, but you should rub your hands more and wash for a minimum 20 seconds and so on. So there's various dialogues that it supports with respect to hand washing. The solution is not trivial, and earlier versions had different levels of accuracy, and this architecture seems to work really well. And so I'm not going to go into a lot of detail about it, but I'll just give you some sense. So the solution really takes this bottom part here is a convolutional neural network, and it has three convolutional layers, 1, 2, and 3. And for each of these layers, we add this thing called squeeze and excite block, which is another architectural feature. And that block is developed by other people, but we use it, and it learns the correlation between the filters in the convolutional layer. And so we have this represents kind of the relationship of your hands to each other. So it learns the spatial relationships. And in parallel, we use an LSTM, and we add to that a self-attention architectural unit so that it focuses on certain parts of the inputs that are more important, as well as does the dynamics of the hand washing and the temporal relationships. These numbers down here just say how many filters are in each of these three layers. And so anyway, if you want more information about how this is really working, you can see our published paper we did our own data set where we gave people three practice runs to teach them how to use the WHO approach. We had 14 participants, and they each did 19 sessions over multiple weeks. And we had video for ground truth, and we compared iWash is the name of our system. And we compared to these three state-of-the-art solutions, and we basically, for the different 10 steps, we are more accurate roughly by about 10% for most of the steps, although for some of them, compared to certain solutions, we're significantly better. All right, so the second thing is the dealing with mental health, and I'm going to discuss our distance emotion recognition and anxiety. For distance emotion, if a person is living in a home, there could be a microphone in the home. There could be, if you go to a doctor's office, it could be a microphone there. So for this ambient intelligence environment, people may not be right next to the microphone. And there's been many solutions for detecting these kinds of emotions, happy, sad, angry, neutral, when you're next to the microphone or you're a fixed distance. But when you're not near the microphone, it's a much more challenging problem. So I'm going to describe our solution for that and also our solution for anxiety. So as I said, if you're near the microphone or you're a fixed distance from the microphone, many solutions already exist for detecting motion. But if you're walking around in some ambient intelligent environment, then you might be a different distance, you might be further away, there might be multiple people, there might be even more people all at different distances, some not right next to each other and so on. And we end up with like these four problems over here to solve. There's reverberation from the environment, there's ambient noise, a lot of it sometimes. There's deamplification of speech, which just means that as further away you are from the microphone, the less amplified detection is happening, and then people could be speaking over each other and so on. And so our solution has three parts. I'll go through each one. The first is we create what we call distance agnostic features, and then we convert these to code words. And then secondly, we create a new feature modeling technique called Emo2Vec, which is a vector embedding, for those of you who know what that is. And then we just input that to a standard LSTM. So those are the three parts. These two, we believe, are novel. This one is just standard. Okay, so the first thing we did was we said, if we're not near the microphone, can we identify features which are agnostic to distance? And so we started with 231 low-level features. And these 231 were chosen from the literature where they really work well with when you're near the microphone. And so this is the kind of features there are. And when you take these and you take its delta and delta delta, you end up with 231 low-level descriptors. And we did experiments where we had people speaking and we had 7 or 8 microphones all at different distances. And we could tell like that it turned out that these 48, we found 48 low-level descriptors features that were somewhat or very agnostic to distance. So we use these features and not these features. So that's the first step. But when we get these features, we convert them to what's called audio code words. And let me explain that. And so let's say I have this signal here, acoustic signal shown above, and I'm going to typically, you know, look at a portion of the signal, like that's what this little bars down here mean. And usually you have a sliding window on them. And then when you look in here, you look at the signal, you try to figure out what the features are. And so normally in our solution, we use 48 features. So we figure out what are the 48 features for this part of the signal. However, I can't draw a 48 dimensional space. So imagine that there's only X and Y here, and there's two features. So then I can draw it. So what I might end up with is that I process this segment, maybe I'm in training and I process this segment. And for every one of these, I get a point, two-dimensional point. So, and I do this over and over again, and I end up with clusters of points in different places. And then I would choose the centroid of those as an audio word. And so all of these clusters are here, and the centroid of each one is called an audio word. And then when it's being used, for example, a new point might come in. I have an audio signal and I determine it's, in this case, XY features, and it's in this part of the space. We map it to the closest audio word. So we don't have to have infinite numbers of points or infinite numbers of features. We end up with some fixed numbers, which is the word number of words in your vocabulary. And another word is detected, another feature set is detected, we map it, and they may be the same. So that word and that word are so close to each other, we just encode them as a single entity and don't treat them as slightly different from each other. And we tested anything like from 500 to 2500 using k-means clustering. You have to choose how many code words you're going to create. And one interesting result was that different emotions, for example, I think sad required 250 code words, and something like happy only required 1,000 code words to get good results. Now, another thing that's the second step is creating a vector representation of the code words. Because the code words only represent a little slice, right? They don't represent how slices are related to other slices. And so what we've done is we, in this example, let's assume here's a whole bunch of training data, and there's a code word we label A, another one B, and there's a D, and all of these are code words that appear in happy signals. And if I look at A, I wanna look at what code words surround A. And here I might have P, Q, R, S, T, for example. And I look at B, and B has a P, Q, R, S, T also surrounding it. So A and B are very much related to each other in terms of happiness. And so we would basically create a vector representation of A and B that are similar to each other because they're both representing something about happiness. Now, alternatively, if we have C, a different code word, it might also have P, Q, R, S, T relationships. But C is actually, say, not happy. And so even though it has a similar surrounding context, it's not as part of the happiness. So it vector representation would be not close to A and B. So that's more or less what I was saying. Then we just simply take an audio signal as shown up here. We would, you know, look at, in our case, 48 features here. And then we would, these are the robust low-level features. And then we convert that to their vector embedding. And then we put it into an LSTM. And as we move in time through the voice sample, we're going to the next stages in the LSTM. And then the output is whether this is a happy or sad or neutral, basically, or anger. We've evaluated this with different data sets. We actually even created our own data set. We worked with people at USC where 12 families were brought into a lab and they were eating dinner and there were spontaneous discussions. And we tried to generate different emotions from them based on questions that they were given to talk about and so on. And it turns out that the literature data sets and this data set give us basically similar kinds of results. We also compared our work to four baselines and we show the solution is basically like 16% better than the best baseline. More details, you know, are found here. But let me also mention that just to give you 16% better is good, but you know what's the absolute kinds of accuracy? So here we have both accuracy and recall. And the accuracy and recall for angry, happy, sad are in the 90% range, which is quite good, especially given people are not near the microphone and they have all these realistic issues about what noise levels are there, reverberation, and so on. One observation we made in looking at the data was that in the past, people originally had trouble distinguishing between happy and angry. And many times this data and information was observed by active data sets, having people act out happy and sad. And but both of those use energy-based features. And so both happy and angry speech tend to have very strong volume and so on. So then it's we got rid of those features basically, and so we were able to distinguish between happy and angry much better. And also in the real world, laughter is some extra information that you can build your solution on that also helps discriminate. Not always. I mean, people are not always laughing when they're happy, but if they are, then it helps identify a happy state. We also looked at what if we, you know, didn't eliminate the distorted features and we just used the original 231 features. Well, we end up with about a 10% drop in accuracy and recall and so on for angry, happy, and sad, all of them. So it's a helpful feature to do, helpful approach. Also, you know, the effective distance, we do lose accuracy as people move away, but if a person moves from the mic or to around 6 meters away, dropping accuracy is only about 5%. And we saw the state of the art, that accuracy level drops about 12%. So I think we've improved the situation there. All right. So the last point I want to bring up is looking at, you know, kind of mental disorder. And one really significant problem is anxiety. 11% of Americans suffer from anxiety. And in general, most people use fully supervised learning, which is really, really difficult for speech because it's hard to kind of label all the different parts of speech of what's representing anxiety. And so we applied a solution based on what's called multiple instance learning. And it's a weekly supervised learning technique. We also created a new feature modeling, you know, kind of a vector embedding, but this case it's called NN2VEC. It's different from the previous example I gave for you know, kind of mood. And then we have a new classifier where we combine, this is a bidirectional LSTM with multiple instance learning. And combining those two together make for about accuracy in the 90% range. And overall, these are 17% better than using the state-of-the-art baselines. All right, so let me explain a little bit about what multiple instance learning is and how we use it. So let's assume that this top curve is a voice sample from somebody, and it is a voice sample from someone suffering from mental disorder such as anxiety. However, so let's say they're talking for 10 seconds here. So I might be able to label the whole thing as anxiety, right? But where is the anxiety in the speech? Is it here? Is it here? Maybe it's just here. And it's the only place in the speech where it's labeled. So if I think of it, if I label this all as anxiety, then I'm falsely labeling this part as anxiety and so on. And it really hurts the classifiers a lot. However, in other case, maybe that's where the anxiety disorder is, or maybe it's here. And maybe it's all three of them, okay? But we don't know. All we know is this whole episode was treated as a positive example of anxiety. And then this bottom one here is that we label this as non-anxiety. So there is no representative example of the speech inside this signal that represents anxiety. Right. So what we're going to do is very similar to the previous solution. We're going to use code words again. So let's say I'm training and I have this speech coming in and I know that this whole thing is a positive audio clip. And I don't know that this is false here yet. And I'm basically like say, looking at this part of the speech, which happens to be true positive. And again, we're sliding a window, looking at the features in the signal. Those features are being created into code words, just like here. So we segment into these little segments. We use code words for these segments. And then we're going to take those code words and find relationships of the code words to each other by a vector embedding, just like we did before, except in this case, vector embedding, the emo2vec we built in the previous solution doesn't work here. And we had to come up with a different one, which we call NN2vec, where the NN stands for a neural network. So we use a neural network to learn these embeddings. Right. And so as an example, if we have of this NN2vec feature modeling is, let's say we have these three positive examples of speech, that is anxiety. And in here we have these code words, you know, 2, 1, 2, 3, 1. And here we have similar code words. And here we have similar code words again. Then each of these kind of words would be trained to be positive examples of anxiety because they're connected to other ones that also have that kind of characteristic. And then taking this and putting it into a classifier, people have done work with multiple instance learning, but they've used an SVM and a DNN. Neither of these really are RNNs. And so, you know, these are more static, like descriptions of something, and they use multiple instance learning. And we feel like these fail to account for some of the temporal dynamics in a speech segment. So we applied it to an RNN. And this is kind of a busy diagram, but I'll walk through it a little bit to give an idea of the solution. So on the left here is the audio signal. Instead of, I just draw it vertically now. Let's say it starts from the top and it goes down in time. And so we, again, have a segmentation. We segment the signal. We create, look at all the features in a signal that creates this audio word. We use the audio word to do the vector embedding. And then we collect a bunch of these and put them into what's called a bag for the training. And then going through this, you have multiple of these bags. And then each of these bags is going to be trained as bidirectional. This is a bidirectional LSTM. So in training, you can predict what's going forward and you can also predict what's going backwards. And you basically can then train this network to detect anxiety. And in the end, each of these layers of the network are producing an instance score. And after you look at a bunch of these signals, you looking at whether the instance score is saying that this is anxiety or not. I mean, that's basically the output is going to be anxiety or not. And so for the training, you kind of do this and then you run through and learn all of the weights and so on in the LSTM. And then when at runtime, when you're using it, we do the same thing. We still collect a segment of these and then put it through the network. And then it creates an instance score. It decides whether or not this is anxiety. Here the evaluation, we used 105 participants. Now this anxiety was for college students giving talks. Okay, so there's still a lot more to do with anxiety, I believe, because it's different for different populations. And so this was done, and there's another paper here that describes these solutions. We're not gonna talk about the depression, but the solution also works for detecting depression. And it'll give you a little bit of sense of the ideas and results. And so one thing is, you know, how much data should we collect and listen to before we make a decision about whether this person is anxious or not? And so this chart shows the F1 score on the y-axis and the segment window that we're looking at. So for example, if we only look at 1 second intervals of speech, we only get an F1 score of 83%. Okay. But if we look at about 13 to 15 or 13 to 16 segments of speech, we get close to 90%. And this is in contrast to mood. In mood, you normally see very good performance when you're doing about 5 seconds of speech. And it looks like to detect accuracy, anxiety more accurately, you need more data, basically, it looks like. All right. This here says, what is kind of the best level of numbers of audio states that work best. And we found for anxiety in this context with these undergraduate students, we needed about 3,500 audio states. That was kind of the maximum. We also studied whether the NN2VEC that I show here, that's the one we developed for this and where we get F1 scores of 90%. We compared it to what if we use the EMO2VEC that I just presented in the previous part of the talk, or iVector, which is very well known and used in the literature, or we have other kinds of baselines, and we see basically about a 15% improvement by using the specialized embedding. Similarly, another thing to compare against is that I said that this, our solution here, the BLSTM with multiple instance learning, we also compared it to what if we used a DNN, multiple instance learning, or MI stands for multiple instance learning, actually SVM. These are from the state of the art. Or we, even if we don't use weekly supervised, but we can somehow torturously label everything and we use supervised learning techniques, a DNN, a CNN, and a combination of CNN and bidirectional LSTM. Here we see even the very best solution is ours with 90%, but the second best was this, the LSTM, when it's supervised. And so we still get higher accuracy than a supervised learning technique. So briefly, in summary, I'm trying to say smart and connected health is moving forward. It's based on wearables as well as in situ systems. I think we should be pushing towards ambient intelligence, where this cognitive assistant could be on your smartwatch and in the environment, and they would need to exchange information between each other, and we need to incrementally improve this the cognition of these systems, the intelligence of these systems, in that I do think still acoustic modalities are going to still be very, very prominent. And I want to thank some of the students that did most of this work, and unfortunately for me, most of them are gone now, and they're taking positions at other universities for the most part, and I certainly give them a lot of credit. So I'm happy to take questions.
So thank you, Jack, for the excellent presentation. I'd like to give a virtual round of applause to you for that. So we have some questions coming in, so I will go through them one at a time. So the first one is, would like to hear about applications of AI for the hard of hearing, such as smarter hearing aids that perform better in the real world environments. Hearing aid today are far from accurately replicating the human ear performance. And it also says that pure hearing has, broader health impacts. They've started living in more restricted spaces, so things, progress that can be made towards this would really go about helping them.
Well, the important thing is I actually need hearing aid, so I really should be going to get one myself, and maybe I could look into it more. I really don't know the technology in hearing aids, so I'm not sure I could answer that particularly. Certainly in a general sense, I would expect that it should be possible that using AI can improve the way that the hearing aid works in different contexts, like noise and background noise and multiple speakers and overlap speakers. So technically, I believe that that could happen. I don't know what they're doing, and I don't know the solutions there.
So could the techniques that you have help in sort of recognizing speech from others and then replaying it, you know?
Yeah. And almost all the pipelines, I didn't explain, you know, when we really use this, there's more to it than just the core part of saying if it's, say, happy or sad or neutral. So the systems that we have to first monitor the environment and ignore silence, first of all. So you have to detect silence and then ignore other sounds like the refrigerator and so on. So detecting those sounds are also necessary. And then finding that, oh, wait, this is speech. And, okay, it's speech. And then if you have it targeted for particular people, like when we do in-home solutions and we have this, say, caregiver and patient, Alzheimer's patient, we only really are interested in their voice, right? If somebody else is visiting, we say that it's not them. So we have to do speaker identification. And then once we detect that this is a speech and it's you know, kind of on the right person, then we can apply the solution for detecting mood. And so these other techniques, signal processing techniques, you know, I think are important that would solve some of these issues about filtering out of, you know, noise and so on. And by the way, I don't think every part of the solution doesn't need machine learning necessarily. I mean, there's a lot of strong signal processing solutions that could be used.
Thank you. Next one is from Masood Rubani. He asks, is the code word for an emotion different from one person to other?
Let's see. I mean, it can be. So if you train just on one person, you would get a certain, say, distribution, and you would maybe come up with certain code words. But what we're doing is we're trying to have enough training data that it's general across many people. And so the code words are more generic. Now, we haven't tried, say, that's a really good observation, actually. We actually haven't tried, say, training just on one person and then detecting that one person's mood.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Next is from Rance Cleveland. So he first comments you on the great talk, and then he says he's wondering about system level performance issues in general, and in particular about the first application you had, voice-based interaction, which has video involving mobile devices. How do you deal with performance energy consumption issues of running neural networks on such platforms?
Yeah, that's a great question also. And one easy way to answer is this: we're going towards, you know, like we're going toward, we don't have all the answers, but, you know, for example, when I was at Oxford, the people there had this really nice result where you could build your classifiers, your very complex solutions, and then you put it into a compiler and you give the compiler the original network as well as the requirements for the platform. So you could give it the requirements of a smartwatch. You only have, you know, 64 megabytes of memory, you have this, that, and it produces a version of the model that fits on that device. So, you know, those kinds of technologies, which we have not employed yet, that they could be helpful, I think, in mapping it down. Mm-hmm. But for example, we normally we don't usually use voice to extract text and for mood, like because of privacy issues, like when we deploy it in real people's homes, they don't want us to record their text. And so we using the kind of you know, properties and features of this, of your speech and not the actual words. But when we do work with first responders, we do need the words. And so the first step is to send it to Google Translator or to some standard translator that they are really so much better than we could. And we couldn't fit those things on a smartwatch, for example, or something like that. And so we make use of tools offline when we can. If the delay is too long or there is a separation, like say you lose the internet, right? And then we have like in the first responder project, we have a backup to use the voice translation on the watch, but it's a much simpler kind of system and it's not nearly as accurate as you would get something like from Google.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Mm-hmm. So the next one is kind of related, you touched upon briefly earlier. So it's by Fan Ye. He's curious how to ensure privacy and how's the acceptance of this among people in general.
Yeah, I mean, that's a pretty broad and important questions. Take the easier one is, you know, how to get acceptance. I think my experience has been in a lot of cases, people will not want any technology. They just don't want it, right? And there's not much you can do for that. However, I also found that if the quid pro quo is strong enough, then they say, oh, this is useful. So for example, one time I gave a lecture at an assisted living and I first asked, you know, how many would like us to put all our sensors in your home? Like nobody wanted them, right? And I said, well, what if we keep you out of a nursing home longer? And they all raised their hand. You know, so they have to see some benefit to it. And even in the project we have now with Alzheimer's patients, even though we only have, you know, three families so far, one person seems like they wanted to do the study to help them with their stress and dealing with their Alzheimer's patient. But now that the study is underway, they changed their mind in some sense saying, oh, it's too much work. You know, I'm too busy to do the interventions. And so they don't see, I guess, that it's valuable yet enough. So we think that as the younger generation comes along and they're so much more attuned to technology, it will be less and less of an issue, mm-hmm. especially if you can show value to it, right? I mean, in the end, that's what has to happen. Otherwise, people won't want to use it. Now, privacy, you can do all the standard things, like, you know, you can, anything you send to the cloud or to a server, you're going to encrypt and you're going to have passwords and, you know, try to protect the data. You could, allow people to opt out. For example, we do allow people to turn their systems off. So when, like, especially the Alzheimer's patients, if they have visitors, you know, they don't want to be recorded anymore, right? So they can turn the system off and they can turn it back on. So that seems to help some people saying, oh, okay, then I'll take the system. Mm-hmm. Or if we explain we're not keeping your words, so they don't want us to record their cursing and so on, right? But they're okay if we record that they're really agitated, but not what exactly they're saying. And so you do have to make some accommodations, I believe.
Yeah, that's interesting. Next one is by Narendra Lakhal, and it's, have you tried models trained with US data on other countries' data for testing? And if yes, how they perform?
We have done that to some extent where some of the sets are from other countries. Like there's one famous German data set for depression. And so we actually use that. And then some of the depression studies and results that we have seem to work okay for you know, across the German data set and a US data set. And you might think that German is not very similar to English. So it might be a problem, but it turns out that, you know, if you can get the core features that are dependent on the accent, then you can do a kind of a pretty good job across languages.
Okay, thank you. The next one is, in your anxiety accuracy experiments, what's your definition or the criteria of labeling a sample as anxiety?
So I didn't quite get the, what is
it? It's basically saying that, you know, when you are doing the experiments, anxiety accuracy experiments, so it's saying, what's your definition or the criteria of labeling a sample as anxiety? Or how do you recognize?
Yeah. So the way these experiments were done by psychologists, and they were using students, and they were defining anxiety as when students were required to give 2 or 3 minute talks, and that the students themselves labeled how anxious they felt and so on. And then there were labelers also that label whether they thought that the student was being, kind of anxious. And so that was more or less the way ground truth was determined on it.
The next question is by Eleanor Schoenfeld. So it's, were you able to accommodate low vision in developing apps for a smartwatch?
Were we developing apps for the smartwatch? Well, the first part of the question, I don't.
So were you able to accommodate low vision in developing apps? So again, I kind of don't, for the smartwatch. What
kind of vision?
Low vision. So maybe less, I think, yeah, it's somewhat, maybe the person who posted it, Eleanor, can clarify with the later what they meant by, because I don't see vision sensors being used here.
Vision like V-I-S-I-O-N, vision? There's no vision on the smartwatch.
There's no vision on the smartwatch, that's what I figured. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
For the EKG, so next question is for the EKG watch app, wondering if you got a chance to evaluate how much time a physician needs to spend to actually go through the recorded data in the cloud. What's their feedback on the extra workload?
Yeah, so that's really a very good question, but we haven't gotten that far, so we don't have a good answer for that. The developing the technology is a difficult process, and we've done that, but we haven't had enough kind of cases and data up there. We do work with physicians who will look at that and maybe give us some feedback. But I think that in the end, what's needed in talking to them about this is that they only should be kind of notified when something looks wrong. And so they won't have time to sit down and look at all these different patients every day, going through all the data and trying to find something. That's not possible, but all the data and everything would be there. And then if something is detected, even the Apple EKG by itself has a alarm system and so on, right? So if it points out that it looks like you better see your doctor or something like that, then we could easily just highlight that to the doctor and say, you need to look at this.
Thank you.
But I don't have any data along the lines of the question, which is a very important question.
Thank you. So the next one is, if we have an application where we do not have enough data to train an AI algorithm, how would you approach to that problem? So how would it impact the accuracy?
Yeah, so I mean, the standard techniques and from the literature is you use data augmentation or you use transfer learning. Those are two standard techniques. And we have been doing a bunch of work on transfer learning. And so, for example, if we were going to say, look at anxiety in elderly, say even dementia patients that living at home, then could we learn from the anxiety data that we've already collected on college students? And so the transfer learning would be able to say, let's build upon that information and then have just a little bit of training data and then try to have a new classifier that is effective for for elderly. And it's a very active research area to identify and develop new transfer learning techniques. The data augmentation thing is more like, you can modify your samples. So if you have a data set with 100 samples in it and you need 500 samples, then you are randomly adjusting the different samples in some reasonable way to make it look like you have more data. And sometimes that works.
So the next question is from Tamar. It said that at the beginning of your presentation, you mentioned about addressing uncertainties in ML models. Would you please elaborate on that?
Yeah, sure. Thank you. So in a lot of machine learning models, at the end, they use softmax, which basically gives you a probability, right? So let's say you're looking at a picture and you want to know if it's a dog or a cat or a mouse or a lion, and it goes through a CNN in the end, instead of just saying dog, it says dog with 70% probability and cat with 20% probability, things like that. So that's one level of uncertainty. You might be able to use softmax. However, when we don't think that's really sufficient. And when we do some of our smart cities work, we're looking at a very, very complex situation and we're trying to predict the state of the city into the future. So given the past state of the city and our current sensor readings, what is the city going to look like in the future? And so obviously we can't be precise, right? How are we going to be precise into the future when there's so many uncertainties and changes? And so what we end up doing is running the future in multiple times, like even hundreds of times. And each time we run the future, we change something in the model so that we get essentially like it's a simulation, right? You were simulating many different possible future paths. And the cone, if you can draw a cone around this, that's called a flow pipe. And so you can have a flow pipe of possible outcomes into the future with a certain confidence level. And that's what we have been doing for smart cities work.
Thank you. The next question is that curious if you have looked at how to detect emotions in the voice when person is speaking a language that has got multiple tones, which indicate the meaning of the sound versus the emotions. So for example, Mandarin, it says has four different tones and the things, and based on the tone, the emotion might be different.
No, we just haven't done that. We focus on English. Mm-hmm. So we haven't really looked at those issues.
So there's also maybe like if a person, if I'm, if I have, let's say, a cough or a cold, so does your model sort of accommodate for any kind of perturbations that may occur because of these aspects?
Well, at the moment, no. I would say you don't take that into account, but I think this comes back to the notion of, how robust is your model? And so if a person has a cold and they sound very different and the model was built on a kind of very sensitive, brittle form, then that slight change is going to be not detected very well and it won't work. However, if you are trying to build robust models, then hopefully that even though it wasn't trained on that, it would still do accurate assessment. And so that's what a lot of people are working on is how to build these robust models. And
So I guess the question that was there earlier on low vision, so it was, I guess, related to the fact that someone with the, which may not be able to see as good, might not be able to see the icons on the watch or read the small print, they may have because there are so many of them on a small space.
Yeah. Right. Well, that's one of the motivations for using voice. And, you know, in the demo, you saw that the person still had to tap a few things, but that's gone away completely. So they can just talk. Mm-hmm. But there are things like, for example, if you detect somebody is stressed and you provide some interventions, and an intervention could be to do a mindfulness activity, like something, if you're familiar with Calm as an app, and if Calm is on your watch, then you know it's really small, you can't see it, so it wouldn't be effective for a person with bad vision, right? Mm-hmm. And even if it was on a smartphone, it probably is still too small for them, and so that intervention wouldn't make sense for a person with poor vision.
Okay. Q, any more? I see that we have at the end of the Q&A list. Any more last call for any questions? If not, then I would again like to thank Jack for the excellent presentation and for the great Q&A at the end. And again, thank you. And also I want to remind the audience once again that we will have office hours today at 3 p.m. and you are very welcome to join that. So thanks once more, Jack.
All right, thank you. See you at 3.
Yeah.
All right. Bye.
Bye.